And happy Thursday, everyone. You are listening to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Peter Salmon.
And Peter, Happy New Year. I haven't seen you since we did the end of the year.
Yeah, recording. Happy New Year to you too.
Yeah, so it's good to be back. We had Vince last week, we have you this week, we have Candace next week, and so, yeah, we're getting back into... Getting back into seeing everyone, and I don't know where that was going. Anyway, End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here Thursdays at 10 a.m. to talk about the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new Steven Spielberg historical drama, The Post. And that is in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the recent news items that have been making waves. And this week, that includes the latest Me Too allegations. And along the way, there's stuff about James Franco, Woody Allen, Elijah Dushku. It just seems to never end. And then we will look at Marvel's next film, Black Panther, and why it may be seeming to be maybe one of the most successful financially so far in the Marvel oeuvre. And then, starting from the top, you'll recall that Ridley Scott... And we talked about this on the show back before the holidays. He scrambled to do the right thing and reshoot Kevin Spacey's scenes in All the Money in the World, which got fairly wide praise for people, given Kevin Spacey's issues and the allegations of sexual assault and harassment and bullying. It seemed to work out well for Mr. Scott and All the Money in the World. It got lots of awards, it got lots of praise, it's made lots of money, not all the money in the world, but some of the money. And then this week, we found out that to do those 10 days of reshoots, Mark Wahlberg got $1.5 million.
I know.
And Michelle Williams got a per diem.
Did she say exactly how much she got?
I don't think it's been revealed how much she got. The source in the original, I want to say, Times story was that it was $1,000, which was basically the per diem.
She said it's $80 in comparison, right. Like $80 per day in comparison to what he gets.
Yeah. Yeah. So she she got some nice meals, and Marky Mark got $1.5 million. Although... on the weekend, Mark Wahlberg had announced that he was giving that $1.5 million to the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund.
So he donated all of it.
So, well, I mean, I think, yeah, nice gesture, but I think the question is, first of all, how did Mark Wahlberg get $1.5 million versus Michelle Williams, who does have higher billing, get $100 per diem? And then on top of that, would this have happened, the rather hefty donation would have happened if this had not been unveiled by the press, which is actually, by the way, a good place, good way to segue into the story later on.
Yeah.
But the movie we're reviewing this week. But yeah,
I still don't think it's fair that he made as much as he did, but he is a lot more famous than her. Like, and he has been more of a consistent actor, like an A-list celebrity for longer. So it didn't surprise me that he did make a bit more, but he made way too much. So I don't think that's fair. I do wish I knew how much she made.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And how do you know how much Christopher Plummer made?
No, that wasn't revealed. But I mean, because he was brought in, he probably made at the very least the seg, because it's all established by the Screen Actors Guild. If you are an actor and the part you're playing, whether it's like a lead or co-star, extra, that determines how much you get paid. And so I would imagine at the very least Christopher Plummer made the base salary for what a co-star would get paid for 10 days of work. Having said that, no, it has not been revealed how much Christopher Plummer would pay, but I would add that Ridley Scott initially said that everyone was coming back pro bono. He was coming back pro bono. Wahlberg was coming back pro bono. Williams was coming back pro bono. The only person getting paid to redo these scenes was Christopher Plummer, because this was him coming in to do fill
okay,
an emergency
but then
situation.
Mark Wahlberg switched that up and he said, "No, I need millions of dollars."
Well,
Okay, yeah, no, that is 100% unfair, now that I fully understand it.
But but it's bizarre, right? Because it turns out the extra layer of – it was bizarre to begin with, but the extra layer of bizarreness is that Mark Wahlberg and Michelle Williams are both represented by the same casting agency or by the same agency. So while it looks like Mark Wahlberg has really good people getting him extra money – maybe Michelle Williams people were like, yeah, she'll come back for a per diem. Or, I mean, it just seemed like there was a lack of communication in those hallways there that, you know, yeah. You have.
So wait, they do have the same agent?
They have the same, well, it's just, I don't know if they have the exact same agent, but they have the same agency.
Oh, okay. Then, yeah, no, it's 100% unfair.
it just, you know, it makes you wonder because, you know, this is the flip side of all the Me Too stuff, right? It isn't just the harassment. It isn't just the assault. It's, you know, the treatment of women in the business that, you know, women, and this, you know, can easily be said across any sector, not just acting, not just filmmaking, or, you know, women seem to take, you know, 70% of what a man makes. In this case, it was like 1/15th of what a man makes. But, it just, you know, it's the bigger systemic problems of Me Too, not just like casting out all the people committing assault, but, you know,
there's a lot of other unfair things that they have to deal with.
Right. Yeah. It just, it comes like in this time too, where, I think it was also before Christmas, there was the story about the E! Network host who found out that she made like a tenth of what her male co-host makes, and she ended up quitting.
Wow, that's awful. She didn't know about that until all this happened.
Yeah, so
I could see why she quit.
You mentioned that, you know, different statuses. Mark Wahlberg is a more pearly well-known entity, bigger star, so forth. So, you know, understand that pecking order. But, you know, when you're talking about two co-hosts on the same plateau, and the one just automatically makes more money because he's a male. That's incredibly sketchy and offensive.
No, the E! News thing just shows how much they get, how much less they get, females, for no reason at all. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, too, that touching on the awards, I mean, by the time this airs, it'll be... I don't think anyone will be talking about Oprah for president anymore, but
The Oprah for president thing is just silly too. Has she made a single comment about it?
I don't think so.
No, I don't even think her agent has, or her manager. It was just someone that sort of pseudo worked for her, or at least for the big studio. Or yeah.
I didn't want to talk about Oprah for president.
Okay.
it's interesting too. It comes like, but you know, in the same awards show, the best director presentation, Natalie Portman came out and said, "Well, here are all the five male nominees for best director too," which was very pointed. And then, of course, this week, the Directors Guild, which is the union that represents all the directors, came out, and Greta Gerwig has one of the slots. So
that's good.
So whoever announces that award will be able to say, well, here are the four out of five male nominees for best director. So, I mean, there's progress there, I guess. Anyway, this is kind of a lead into some of the, again, it's, you know, it was one of those weeks. It's almost hard to believe that there were allegations against James Franco, but those were like at the beginning of the week. And then,
well, and they've existed for longer than that, I think, too.
Mm-hmm.
I think the 17-year-old, I think that has been known for a long time. It's similar to the T.J. Miller incident and the Louis C.K. one. It's just been hidden for a while.
Yeah, it's. What I mean is, it came to light earlier this week, but it's already been eclipsed by a ton of other things.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't until he won a huge award that it blew up.
Well, I think, somebody was, the accuser responded to him wearing one of the Time's Up lapels.
And said it wasn't cool that he was wearing
It's like, nice lapel pin there, James Franco, you know why. But, Yeah, it's since then there's been on the weekend Eliza Dushku alleging the stunt coordinator on True Lies had assaulted her. And then now we're seeing like a kind of a blowback almost against Me Too. There was Liam Neeson in an interview said that.
And he's against it?
He's not against it, but he's kind of alleging that there's now kind of a witch hunt mentality. Let me see if I can find his quotes here. Yeah, it's a bit of a witch hunt. And then he claimed, and then he just kind of dismissed things like groping as like childish stuff.
I can sort of see that. even though the Me Too maybe is going to that degree, I still think it's needed. I still think it's glad that it's happening. It's better than at least everything being hidden. But yeah, there might be some who are lying. You know, maybe James Franco didn't go to the extent that they said, but he did do something. So at least he's been called out for something, even right. If.
And he seemed very effusive in his apology, which is more than some people. But at the same time,
yeah, on the Colbert and the Seth Meyers, I think on both, he said that he is glad that they called him out.
Yeah.
Yeah. At least they're being open and honest and moving the Me Too thing forward.
Right.
My problem, I think, is it being referred to as the Me Too, because it's not just about the hashtag Me Too. And like you said, Liam Neeson is against that. It's just.
I'm not sure if he's against it, but he sounds dubious.
He sounds dubious about it. Yeah. It's just a broad feminist movement.
Right.
In general, it's, yeah.
Well, let me phrase it this way. I think it's reactive. It's reflexive. I think that the problem was so far one way that the backlash has been as equally extreme. So, you know, as we saw with in the world of politics, somebody like Al Franken, whom a lot of, I think it was more than half of the people in his state were polled, and they said that he shouldn't have resigned.
I think
he's no Harvey Weinstein, is what you're saying. That you know, there's a spectrum in terms of this, that it's unacceptable behavior. But I think perhaps the point of view is that for somebody like Al Franken and maybe a James Franco, there's more opportunity for rehabilitation versus
to have a
someone,
comeback, yeah.
Yeah, that someone like Harvey Weinstein or even somebody like Louis C.K. or Charlie Rosen, some of these people.
They're never going to be able to come back, yeah.
One would hope, but...
yeah, I definitely don't think Louis will be able to.
No.
A comedian who's famous as being himself is not going to be able to come back as himself.
Yes. I mean, Kevin Spacey, too, to an extent. I think the sort of the bigger you are, the harder you fall. But I think to Neeson's point and, you know, maybe the point of some of the other people, the reaction has been everybody must go. If there's like the one allegation, even if it's just something like, you know, I don't know. I don't want to say specifically, but, you know, if there's one allegation, no matter how slight, you must go. And I'm not sure that creates a space for learning if that person just has to go away, because what you're just saying is there's no opportunity for rehabilitation and there's no opportunity for reparation, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, it's something like, you know, when Bill Maher used the N-word, you know, a lot of people's like, no, kick him off the air. Well, it also created room for like how I think that was early last year, but given how the year ended up going and how this year has actually started with President Trump saying certain things about certain countries and certain offices, it opened an opportunity where you could talk about the comfort level of some white people throwing around, you know, racially divisive language.
Yeah.
And I wonder if, you know, we're missing an opportunity to do the same with some of the, let's call them lesser offenders, like the James Francos.
Well, I'm glad you're saying that, because Dave Chappelle, in his newest Netflix stand-up, does deal with that. He talks extensively, especially about Louis C.K. So he does deal with that issue a tiny bit, some of them being over-dramatic or... Mm. Made to seem more bad than it actually is.
Mm.
That's what he's trying to show. I don't fully agree with that, but...
Right. But not everybody's... Like, the Weinstein thing...
He does not bring that up. That is just...
No. Well, no, the Weinstein thing too was especially because he of the level of his power and the way he could make or break careers. You know, being cast in a Harvey Weinstein film or a Weinstein Company Miramax film made careers. It won awards. So going against Harvey, you know, who knows how many women that cost. You know, careers, you know, awards, consideration.
The amount of money they deserved.
Money, exactly. Mm-hmm. Speaking of blowback, I did want to address this one, too. 100 French actresses, including Catherine Deneuve, wrote a letter to Le Monde, basically calling the Me Too movement, and I'm quoting here, a puritanical war of purification. Further adding that, though rape is a crime, some people are trying to seduce someone, even persistently, is not basically a crime. So the argument is, I guess, that, you know, it's not a crime to, you know, invite women into your office and or your hotel room and take off your bathrobe to, you know, reveal your erection and that's use that as a form of seduction, even if it's a subordinate, which I know that France is a bit more liberal with these things, but
maybe a bit too liberal
because yeah, it's, you know, when you hear things like Matt Lauer having a like a lock button under his desk, and you know, you hear about Harvey Weinstein and other people like rubbing up against women, you know, that's not seduction. First of all, I don't know where these guys get in their head that you invite a woman to, you know, a hotel room and then take off your robe and then the magic happens.
I don't think they're looking for magic. They're just
it's so silly that, you know, Harvey Weinstein reveals his overweight, aged body to a 20-something actress, and that's seduction. Well, maybe you've watched too many Woody Allen movies, speaking of which. there's some blowback against Woody Allen now.
Oh, wow, there has been for a while.
Well, I mean, it's been there for a while. But it's even bigger now, yeah. It's getting bigger with Rebecca Hall saying she's donating her salary to Time's Up, and you have Greta Gerwig and David Krumholtz saying they regret working with Woody Allen. So I wonder how...
And people are upset with Justin Timberlake because he's going to be in the upcoming Woody Allen.
Well, I think he was in the last one.
So the last one, yeah.
Wonder Wheel, yeah. People are also upset with Justin Timberlake for going on Twitter and going, look at how hot my wife is. not a great week for JT, although... No. I mean, he should know better. He's got a new album out there.
Man of the Woods.
I love that cover art, too. It looks like he's selling brawny paper towels.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's kind of bizarre.
I don't know about bizarre. I think that's what he's going for. He's JT.
Justin Timberlake is many things. I'm not sure rugged is one of them.
No, not at all. He was too good on Disney to be like that.
I mean, well, Ryan Gosling was good on Disney, too. But,
that's fair.
And Ryan Gosling does do rugged okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway. We're going to wrap up the news segment just by talking about the upcoming Marvel movie Black Panther, which stars Chadwick Boseman. Mm-hmm. And as the character who was introduced in Captain America Civil War, he is the king of a hidden African country that is quite technologically advanced, even by Western standards. And it is already, according to Fandango, the highest selling advance ticket for a Marvel movie. So, you know, I wonder if we're going to be looking at another sort of Wonder Woman moment where, you know, we're going to be talking, and it comes out next month, but we're going to be talking this time next month, like, oh, look at all the black people who wanted to see a black superhero on screen. Who would have thought it?
Yeah, possibly. I am glad it's coming out. It will help out with that. A lot of the black issues going on in Canada and the States. Well, it's but partly what they're making it for, right? It's why they're mm-hmm. making it so strong in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
Malcolm X style, sort of. And I personally, I'm really looking forward to it.
Malcolm X is, you mean the movie, not the guy.
Yeah, the movie.
Yeah, because that is an apt comparison, because Malcolm X, of course, was going to be directed by Norman Jewison.
Oh.
Before he wisely stepped aside and Spike Lee took over.
That was wise. I'm glad they did that.
But yeah, I mean, this is, it's quite the paradox in terms of the superhero movie.
Well, and I think it's a huge, not a cult one, but it's a very specific type of people that
mm-hmm.
want to see it, like, the day it comes out.
Yeah.
You know, it's got, like, a very large of the MCU cult following.
Right.
So I think even though it's sold out, I don't think it's going to make as much as, say, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 or the Avengers films. But I could totally see why there's been so many pre-ordered.
Well, I just meant too that it's a majority black cast. It is written and directed by a prominent African-American director.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it's a great cast. I mean, it has a great cast regardless of race, because it's got like Forest Whitaker and Michael B. Jordan
and
Lupita Nyong'o.
Yeah, that's who I was about to say.
Who sent out a Twitter feed like, even I can't get a ticket for Black Panther, which is kind of funny because I'm sure she'll be at the premiere.
I think I also really like how, like Guardians of the Galaxy, it's not set on Earth, or at least not the majority of it set on Earth. It's set in a different kingdom, you know? It'll be more interesting.
Yeah, well, it's in a realm that has not been covered so far, except in, like, maybe bit asides. And
even in the comic books.
Yeah.
The Black Panther isn't, like, you know, an A-list. He's
no.
not Captain America. He's not Iron Man. He's not a well-known Avenger. So I think that's why it's getting
True.
A specific... No, I don't want to say cult because it's bigger than that, but people focusing on it and pre-ordering for it.
Well, let me say this too. Iron Man wasn't always Iron Man. Iron Man came out because of Robert Downey Jr. and the reaction to that movie. Iron Man became an A-lister. I don't think Iron Man was an A-list hero
No.
until that movie.
No.
And if you read Iron Man comics from before Iron Man the movie and then read them after, you can definitely see
very different.
They adapted Iron Man to be more like Robert Downey Jr.
The soundtrack for Black Panther, I don't think we mentioned that.
No,
it
yes.
looks amazing.
Yeah. Well,
and I think that's probably a huge reason why people are pre-ordering for it too.
And the music in the trailers has been great too, because it hasn't sounded like a typical Marvel. It doesn't have like that swelling kind of typical trailer music-y score. It hasn't looked like a typical Marvel movie. I mean, you got people in costume, sure, but it's been very, very grounded in.
Yeah. It's gonna be different.
Yeah, and yeah, the political drama of, you know, this is about a, you know, a country and a guy ruling a country and the implications therein, and a lot of the background of that. I did want to mention this too, that there was an activist in Harlem, Frederick Joseph, who started a GoFundMe page to raise money for kids in Harlem to see Black Panther.
Oh, and that's a great call.
He set a goal of $10,000, and as of Sunday morning, he had made $41,000.
Good.
So there's a lot of kids in Harlem who will be going to see Black Panther, but he also said he was going to donate any money left over to the Boys and Girls Club of America. So, and there's some pretty big donors too. J.J. Abrams donated some money. Chelsea Clinton. Oh, hopefully it's not from that evil Clinton Foundation slush fund. I don't know. Sorry, went into a bit of Alex Jones territory though, and I know that's not how we roll here. Anyway, we're going to get into some real news and some real historical news and how it was portrayed in a movie in just a minute. And to warm us up for that, I dug into the archives here, and I found an artist named Citizen Cope and an album called The Rainwaters. But the song from it, just to tee us up nicely, is called The Newspaper. Because our movie this week is about the newspaper. Not just a newspaper, the newspaper. Anyway, we'll play that bit and we'll come back and we'll review the post. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, well, campus and community radio. Doctor Rich, I forgot to heal. Don't want
want you, but you're still here. God knows that's a miracle. Newspaper got some more people killed, yeah. Vaccine, why some shoot them in the field, yeah. Radio, they turn another deaf ear, yeah. The institution sold everything near. Newspaper got some more people killed, yeah. Magazine, why some shoot them in the field, yeah. Radio, they turn another deaf ear, yeah.
So, can I ask you a hypothetical question?
Oh, dear, I don't like hypothetical questions.
Well, I don't think you're going to like the real one either.
Do you have the papers?
Not yet.
Oh gosh, because you know the position that would put me in. You know, we have language in the prospectus.
Yeah, I know that the bankers can change their mind. That's, and I know what is at stake. You know, the only couple I knew that both Kennedy and LBJ wanted to socialize with was you and your husband, and you owned the damn paper. Well, since the way things worked, politicians and the press, they trusted each other so they could go to the same dinner party and drink cocktails and tell jokes while there was a war raging in Vietnam.
I don't know what we're talking about. I'm not protecting Lyndon.
No, you got his former Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, the man who commissioned this study. He's one of about a dozen party guests out on your
patio. I'm not protecting any of them. I'm protecting the paper.
And that was a scene from The Post, which is the new film from Señor Spielbergo. It stars Meryl Streep, Tom Hanks, Bob Odenkirk, Bradley Whitford, Tracy Lett, Sarah Paulson, Carrie Coon, Matthew Rhys, and Bruce Greenwood. And you can't really tell from the clip there, but it's based on a true story about the Pentagon Papers. Bit of history for young Peter here, since he predates.
Was not alive. Nowhere close to
being
alive.
Well, I wasn't alive either, but I'm closer to 1971 than you are. The Pentagon Papers were actually a study commissioned by the Department of Defense in the midst of the Vietnam War, basically as it was kind of really getting rolling in the mid-60s, and it looked at the possibilities of the United States winning the war and the problems they were facing, and the report made it very, very clear that this was not a war the United States could win. And 5 years after that report was commissioned, young Daniel Ellsberg very courageously, through his job with the Rand Corporation, spent several months sneaking files out of the building, photocopying them, and eventually they were given to the New York Times, and the New York Times started publishing the information they received from the Pentagon Papers in a series, which was then blocked by the Justice Department, which was then under President Richard Milhouse Nixon. And then we catch up here, where the Times has been blockaded from further publication, and Tom Hanks, as the editor of the Washington Post, smells opportunity. And of course, there's also the story of Meryl Streep, who plays Catherine Graham, who was the publisher of the Post. Her family owned the Washington Post for years, and she found herself in the unlikely position of owning the paper, owning the company that owns the paper. And what they're talking about in that clip there was the Post, the company, was going public at that time on the stock exchange, and there's a clause about a potential disaster, which, if you were a newspaper publishing government secrets, could have been interpreted as disaster. So, you know, very high stakes. And talking about this movie, let me start by saying I think the comparisons to Spotlight, which came out a couple of years ago, I think that they're both about newspapers,
yeah,
publishing.
Both biopics.
Both biopics in a sense, but I think where Spotlight was, interestingly, they shared screenwriters as well. But I think where Spotlight was very procedural in terms of how newspapers do what they do and investigative reports happen, This is more of a newspaper thriller.
It was way more exciting than I expected. Yeah. It was a biopic. It was Steven Spielberg, and The Bridge of Spies was enjoyable, but it got a little boring. So I wasn't expecting this film to be as fast-paced as it was.
I like Bridge of Spies.
Oh, I liked it, but this one I really liked.
Yeah.
When it comes to the speed, the thrills.
Well, Bridge of Spies struggled because it was two very different stories involving the one character.
Yeah, whereas this was just one central story.
Right. Interestingly, both involve scenes at the Supreme Court, and starring Tom Hanks. But yeah, it's funny because the movie begins, begins with Ellsberg going to photocopy the first round of papers after he comes back from a trip to Vietnam, and after hearing Robert McNamara, Secretary of Defense, go in front of the microphones about how everything is fine, he starts this process, and there's a scene where the papers are being photocopied, and he has a couple of people there assisting him, and they're like collating, they're cutting off the top secret watermark that's on the bottom of these pages, and the music, the editing, it makes it all feel like photocopying these papers is the most thrilling thing that could ever happen to anyone. And I guess it is, because, there is very real dangers. Mm-hmm.
I don't know Ellsberg, if it would have been exciting for them. It would have been scary.
Right. But, there's this very real tension to that scene, and all it is people photocopying things.
Mm-hmm. It was tense for us, so I'm really curious in the States, especially seniors in the States, or not necessarily seniors, people who were alive in that era.
Right.
I'm curious how they deal with it. I'm curious how many applauds and things like that you get in the audience. Because when I went to see it, there was the one older lady who, when Meryl Streep in the one scene cries, the very important Meryl Streep scene, she just starts applauding. And it's only halfway through the film, so she's probably from the States.
Yeah, Meryl had a couple of really good scenes in this one. I did see this yesterday at a matinee, it was a packed matinee, oddly enough. It was early afternoon matinee. It was packed, mostly older people.
Same here.
Yeah.
I saw it 7.
And people applauded at the end.
Yep.
People were very taken with it. So I would be interested to know what the reaction is.
Yeah, the news must have at least been represented hugely in Canada. Because it's the same here. The majority were seniors and huge applause.
Yeah, it's so a big hit with the boomers.
Who
remember this.
Oh, it's going to make it's $50 million it needs now.
But I think to go back to Meryl, she's always outstanding. I think the one scene that was affecting for me, and especially in light of all this Me Too stuff, was one of the scenes closer to the end where she's talking to her daughter about how her husband married into the family. She was the actual daughter of Phil Graham, who owned the paper. And it was her husband who became his successor. And she's talking about, like, that's just the way it used to be. And I didn't think twice about, shouldn't I inherit the company? It just was natural. He was the man. Mm-hmm. He inherits. And I was proud of him. I never thought I would be put in that position. And there's something... I felt that something so real and raw about that, not just about the times, but in terms of when we're talking about the systemic issues, that a lot of the things that happen, and we hear this in the defense of like somebody like Harvey Weinstein, we're like, that's just the way it was when I grew up in the 60s.
Well, oh, yeah.
As if that's an actual reason for that to exist.
Well, I think one of the shots where Meryl Streep is just walking after a very important event, which she won.
Yeah.
Or did she? as she's walking, and there's a shot of a bunch of fans or people who really support what she just did, and every single shot is a female.
Right.
So I think that might have re-edited that after the whole Weinstein thing.
It's, yeah, I'm that
or at least purposely done it to show that.
Yeah,
that's what we need.
That did seem very purposeful. That it's they're coming out of the Supreme Court, and all the majority male reporters. I don't think there's probably a female reporter who are talking to the New York Times people, and the she's leading the Washington Post delegation out of the Supreme Court, and she's coming down the stairs, and she's surrounded by young women. The other scene I found very powerful was the scene where they're talking about going to print or not. and she's basically at the front of the front of this table, and the guys aren't sitting at the table with her. They're all kind of leaning around her,
yeah,
and leaning in, and these are all the guys who are like, we can't do this, we can't publish it, it's like the end of the company, it's the end of the paper, you know, we're all going to prison, you're going to prison. And
yeah, a lot of people that worked for her,
yeah,
didn't treat her like a boss whatsoever.
Right. And that's, you know, that's again, there's a scene early on where they're at the boardroom and they're pitching their perspectives. And you see her, the first scene you meet Kat Graham is that she's going over the talking points and the reasons why going public is such a good idea and why the price is what it is. And then she gets into the actual boardroom and it's like a mob that, you know, the men can't let her get in a word in edgewise. And then when it's actually her turn to talk, she feels like, well, it's, you know, how can I talk? Because I feel like I'm kind of an outsider here, even though it's her family, it's her company, it's her paper. And it's just all these scenes are really subtly done. And the message is really delivered. And you know, of course, Streep is Streep. And you cannot deny. Oh, yeah,
she was great.
Yeah.
Same with Tom Hanks.
Tom Hanks is great because they're always talking about how Ben Bradley's like a pirate. He's like a pirate newspaper. He's kind of like a swashbuckler, I guess, where he's
like a bit of a rebel.
Yeah, but and that's kind of interesting because I don't know how often Tom Hanks is the rebel part.
Yeah, well, he wasn't like I can see why he was a rebel in this film, a newspaper rebel.
He's right? A newspaper rebel, yeah.
I couldn't see him as, you know, like a thief or even someone who does a bunch of graffiti or something. So this, no, it made sense though.
Tom Hanks in Canadian graffiti. I would love to see that.
he was just, he broke some laws, but to be a really good person. So that made sense.
Yeah, I mean, his position is like, we print, this is like information vital to the public, we print, I don't care.
Yeah. And, although I don't know if the real person did it for that reason. He might have just wanted his newspaper to make more bank, but.
Well, sure. yeah, it's, well, I mean, also, part of it is also the spite and the intentions between newspapers and, you know, having a rival, and his thing was like trying to outdo the Times, and he sends like an actual copy boy to New York. The beginning of the film to find out what's going on at the Times. And that's another thing I really liked about this film, all like the newspaper mechanics. And there's a scene where Neil Sheehan, who's the reporter at the Times who broke the Pentagon Papers, he's working off-site on this. And I guess he's a copy boy from the Times. He goes in and is flashing his ID around like he's the FBI. But he's like a copy boy from the Times, and he's trying to get these the article to the Times building, running through New York traffic to get there. And I love that. And I love the scenes of them actually putting the paper together.
That is what I really love.
It's newspaper porn. It's delicious.
Yeah, yep. They teach you that briefly in history classes, you know, how it was invented. But I was good getting a, like a full-on glance at how they're making, and I'm assuming probably still making, the newspapers, the physical newspapers.
Well, it's a bit different with InDesign.
But yeah.
There's not quite so much typesetting anymore. But yeah, that was fascinating. And
was it cinematography in general?
Yeah.
No, it was
solidly shot.
And there was a lot more shaky cams than can be in some, like the Bridges Spies. I don't think there was as many.
Yeah, there's something a bit more visceral and a bit more intimate about it, I think, than Spielberg typically goes.
Yeah, it was his cinematographer for Saving Private Ryan.
I think, Janusz Kaminski.
Yep.
Yeah, who I think has shot all of Spielberg's stuff since Schindler.
Oh, wow.
I think. Yeah, and the John, like, this is Spielberg. Like, he works with a lot of the same people. And, of course, John Williams, too.
Yeah.
This is some of John Williams' best work, I think, in a while.
I think so.
Yeah.
It was more subtle than he usually does, I find. But it worked really well with the how you're supposed to feel tense, you know?
Yeah, it creates such great tension. And again, it's in scenes where you would think there'd be a lot of tension, because there's one where they're on the phone with Kat Graham about going to print.
Yeah.
And this is where it kind of all works, from the editing to the shooting to this, to Streep's acting to Williams' score. This all comes together, this seminal moment, and it's like cutting back and forth to you know, Bradley saying, like, let's print, and all the lawyers saying, no, don't do it. And Streep's like, yeah, let's go, let's do it. And it's such a great, and you're on the edge of your seat watching, trying to make a decision over to print a story or not. And it is so well done. It is so much fun. Because, you know, she says yes. And I mean, historically speaking, it's not a spoiler to say that the Washington Post printed the Pentagon Papers. And that the Supreme Court said they could. But the tension level is so magnificent. It's so enjoyable. And I think you leave the theater, at least I did, you know, with kind of like a sense of hopefulness and a sense of like kind of giddy excitement. And maybe because of what I do in my day job, but
more excited than I've been in a long time for newspapers. It made me really binge on Wikipedia, looking up all of these people. Like the more, you know, Bob Odenkirk's character.
Right.
Yeah, I wanted to know more about him. I think he did a great job.
He was really great.
Yeah, he wasn't in it as much as the trailers showed or as much as I thought, but you know, he was pretty central. He was good.
Yeah, Bob Odenkirk, he's got some, you know, some weird career charisma here where he's – this in Better Call Saul, where it's like he comes from a comedic background and he can use that in ways that sort of enhance – the dramatic character he's playing. It gives it a bit more humanity here. And there, I couldn't remember what scene I was kind of chuckling at him at. Ooh. It might have been the scene where he was like calling on the yeah, it was at the telephone.
Every time I saw him on the telephone, man, I was thinking I was watching Better Call Saul.
It's just, yeah, when he's like, call from a secure line. So he goes outside to the phone bank of payphones, and he's trying to find Ellsberg.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and his first scene where you see him, you also see David Cross.
Right.
So the first thing I thought of was Mr. Show.
Yeah, that was an interesting little thing for Spielberg to sneak into. Yeah.
And the David Cross, he was so subtle in it, but he's the Watergate man.
Yeah.
That's an example of me Wikipedia-ing my night away. And because, I don't know, I hope he, if there's a sequel.
There's a sequel.
It could be about David Cross solving the whole Watergate thing.
Sequel, they turn all the President's Men into a sequel to the Post. That might be interesting and remake that. But I will say that I think the cap at the end with the Watergate break-in, I think that's Spielberg going a little too far with
he wasn't needed.
Yeah, because he did that same thing in Lincoln too, where he shows after Lincoln and the Congress passes the 13th Amendment, he shows like Lincoln being assassinated and dying, and then the aftermath of that. And I'm like, I thought that was an extra thing that movie didn't need. I think the movie, if it had ended with Lincoln going off to Ford's Theater, I think people would have got it.
Yeah,
and I think at the end here, first of all, they did a great thing with Nixon, which was they used actual Nixon audio from, I guess, the White House tapes. And they, I don't know if it was a stand-in or what they did, but it's all shot through the window
of the White House.
And so you see Nixon on the phone, like,
just the back of Nixon.
Yeah, just see the back of his head. But it is so, it's so Dr. Claw, it's magnificent.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's just so great.
Well, it was great getting to hear what the actual Nixon said too.
Yeah, and but at the end it's just like, I will never let the Post in here again. They're not going to get any press credentials at all. And then it cuts to the Watergate break. And I think it's pretty much axiomatic in terms of the minds of most people that it was, you know, Woodward and Bernstein also with the Post later who did the Watergate thing, because you know, Spielberg seems to like get the nail in, but I'm gonna hit the nail a couple more times just to make sure it's in. And it's, I appreciate it, Steven. I realize that, you know,
he loves his American history.
But I mean, it is interesting looking at Spielberg where he is right now, where this seems to be where he where his real passion is, and and going back to Bridge of Spies, although that movie had its issues, I think there was real passion behind it and a real point he was trying to make to it, versus something like the BFG, which would be more classically Spielberg and like the tradition of things, something like E.T. or Hook or or that kind of thing, where I felt that kind of felt flat. That did not have the energy of those earlier films. Even something like Hook, which is a disaster, still has an energy to it. But the BFG just felt had no energy to it. It felt like he was it was kind of like a pro forma job, like he owed somebody something. Which I don't know if that was the case, but this is where his passion is, telling these stories, these very tight, very historically, very sort of metaphorically pointed allegories of, you know, because I think he said this was a movie he had to make right this minute, right now. And when you see it, you kind of understand, because it's got the Me Too stuff in it. It's got the press access stuff to it.
Yeah, there was the one little line that had to do with how this Pentagon paper is going to change everything when it comes to the American politics and make it so much better. And it was, I don't know, the line was very, I feel like it was written on purpose for the whole.
Sure.
Yeah, current things going on.
There was a,
because the Pentagon thing, it helped for a bit, but it did not fix a lot of the state's problems.
Well, no, it fixed that. It didn't even fix the Vietnam problem. Vietnam went on for 2 more years.
Yeah.
But yeah, the I can't remember what the exact line is, but somebody says, you know, it's like this will, you know, there will never be, you know, a crisis like this in the country again. And that's very reflective of a lot of movies are throwing this line in, because I was rewatching Kong Skull Island, and the first scene with John Goodman is they're in Washington and people are demonstrating against the Vietnam War, and he's like, mark my words, there will never be a more screwed up period in this country.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's like, well, that was on the nose. But I mean, that's part of it. But I think, you know, one or two lines here, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But I think by and large, this movie does exactly what Spielberg wants to do, and exactly what I wanted to do. And you know, like I said, the fact that they turned it basically into a thriller, even though there's nobody chasing anybody in cars or no guns, and you know, it's not exactly North by Northwest, but you are on the edge of your seat watching all this happen. And it's purely a newspaper story about trying to beat the competitors, trying to get information out there, having to navigate the waters of press access and you know, the legality of publishing information. And you're right, it's, you know, it's odd to look at this situation where you have the Tom Hanks character saying like, oh, they're not gonna tell us what to print, we're just gonna, and to see how far it's come, where we do know of situations where the Pentagon has leaned on newspapers to not go to print on whether that's WikiLeaks or whether that's specific operations, whether that's what's happened recently with the four soldiers killed in Africa. It's, you know, it's not a lesson that seemed to have sticked. So I hope that if there's obviously a lot of praise for the Post coming from media quarters on it, but I hope that they don't just see it as a remembrance, as a reliquary of how things used to be, but rather as a push in terms of how things can be. Like, screw access. Like, if you get thrown out of the White House, that should be a badge of honor.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's just, it's not just for people who love politics and American history or Spielberg fans. It's thrilling enough that I think anybody would enjoy it. It can be a bit boring. It is all about newspapers and
sacrilege.
Yeah.
Nothing boring in newspapers.
And I don't think Meryl Streep is, she's just Meryl Streep in it. It's not, you know, Meryl Streep being a special Meryl Streep. It's just,
well, I mean, what can Meryl Streep do at this point that would surprise us?
Yeah.
It's,
yeah.
You know, I, you know, somebody like Bradley Whitford, he is surprised. Like, first of all, he's the father in Get Out, and now he's like this guy in this who's like does not like the idea of this woman running this company. And it's funny, given where he came from, quite famously as you know, one of the more vocally liberal guys on the West Wing in the Bartlett administration, that now he's playing these like, these white privilege villains, let's call them. It's really, and he's good. He's great. I like Bradley Whitford a lot. Bruce Greenwood, I want to highlight too. He played Robert McNamara.
Oh, okay.
So it's interesting too because Bruce Greenwood played JFK in 13 Days.
Oh,
so he got a bit of a demotion playing the Secretary of Defense. Mm. But
there was a lot of great minor actors as well, like Zach Woods from Silicon Valley and people like him.
Yeah, he was one of the lawyers.
Yeah, he was. Oh, and the other lawyer was, I always forget the actor's name, but the evil redheaded dude in the last season of Breaking Bad. That's the
another
only way I can describe him.
Connection.
But then, of course, Spielberg regulars and... and Alison Brie, of course.
Yeah, she was Kate Minor's daughter, but it was minor. But they were good together.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think... a metaphor fitting for her experience on Glow. She wasn't hitting beneath her weight class on that. Alison Brie was really good in those scenes. Mm-hmm. And Tracy Letts, who is, again, one of those actors you kind of see and you don't really know his name, but he was really good as kind of Cat Graham's sort of primary advisor. And you think for a while there he's kind of sold out with the other guys, and he turns out to
was he the one with the white rimmed glasses?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was him.
Main villain in Billy Madison. No, I thought his role was the best at showing how even though Meryl Streep was the owner of the company, she wasn't in full control. Unfortunately, he kind of seemed to view himself as being the one in control.
Well, and that, but he defers to her in the end.
Yeah.
Which
is, of course,
interesting. But yeah, there's a lot of, there's a lot of gray there. Mm-hmm. And I love the. We're kind of just talking about what we love now, individual things. But I love when they're at Ben Bradley's house, going through the papers, and you sort of see his daughter selling lemonade, and she's like progressively getting more and more richer as the hours are going by. Eventually, you see her just like wandering around in the background counting the cash. It's hilarious, but yeah, it's such a delightful movie on multiple levels, and I'll be very interested to see what happens next, because Spielberg's next film is in the can. It is Ready Player One. And if anybody saw Star Wars over the break, I think the Ready Player One trailer was attached to that.
Yeah, it was.
Based on the Ernest Cline book, which is basically a Spielberg reference encyclopedia.
See, wait, it's not coming out anymore, you said?
No, it's coming out in March or April.
Oh, okay.
It's in the can.
Cool.
That's a Hollywood expression. It's in the can.
Yeah. When it comes to reviewing the post, one thing I want to mention,
mm-hmm.
a lot of people in the New York Times and everybody in the newspaper companies that aren't the Washington Post are not happy with it. There's been comments about how they did not represent the New York Times and the other ones nearly well enough. What? And they all gave Ben Bradley some hate. They said it was accurate, except for they're not being there's just not nearly as many scenes of the New York Times, because they did do it first, right?
The New York Times did to the New York Times's credit, they did run the Pentagon Papers first. But having said that, they were injuncted by the court from doing it, and so the Post came to the rescue. And maybe what's a good New York Times movie? I'm trying to think. Is there one?
I don't think so.
Oh, maybe that's maybe that is a legitimate gripe, that there isn't a great New York Times movie. There's a great Boston Globe movie, which is Spotlight. There's a couple of great Washington Post movies, including The Post and All the President's Men. Is there a great...
Not that I could think of.
Yeah,
I've tried.
So
yeah, they're just a little bummed.
Okay. Well, maybe that's something to think about in the future, is we need a great New York Times
movie.
Yeah,
if anyone listening is a director... Make it.
Well, we do have...
It'll be new and fresh.
Yeah, Vince. If Vince and
Vince.
Tim are looking for ideas...
Yeah, go for it, Vince and Tim.
Yeah, they can make the first great New York Times movie.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's it for this show. We'll brainstorm some New York Times movie concepts and we'll call it a day. If you want to hear this episode again or any episode of End Credits, you can go to our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. We are on the social medias, on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show and on Twitter at End Credits Radio. Peter, when you're not brainstorming ideas for the New York Times movie? Where can people find you online?
Mr. Towerak, spelled the exact same way it sounds, on Twitter or YouTube.
And I will be back here on CFRU later today at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Source's Guelph with Scotty Hertz there. I have it on good authority. He will be in studio in person versus last week's FaceTime appearance. He should be well enough again. And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we'll be back here next Thursday at 10 a.m., for more end credits. We will see you then.